Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Shortcoat Podcast.
Weird news,
fresh views,
helpful clues and interviews
by students for students.
Subscribe to our weekly show at theshortcoat.com.
Welcome back to the Shortcoat Podcast, a production of the students at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine and its Writing and Humanities program. I am Dave Etler. Before we start today's show, let me remind you, as I always do, that I'm paying attention on Facebook, Twitter, shortcoat.com, many different places, so that you can get in touch. And we'd love to get a voicemail message from you. That'd be cool. 347-SHORT-CT, 347-746-7828. I love messages because it means I don't have to prepare as much for the show, and I am a lazy person. We're here with John Pienta.
Hello.
We're here with Matt Becker.
Hello.
We're here with Gabe Lancaster.
Good afternoon.
Lancaster?
Lancaster, yep.
We're here with Jack O'Brien.
Hello.
Is it O'Brien?
O'Brien.
Oh, okay.
You're trying way too hard.
I'm inordinately pleased this week that we actually did get a listener question. It wasn't a voicemail, but you know, beggars can't be choosers. It's awesome. So I think it's a win-win-win because I didn't have to prepare. Ross from Carnegie Mellon sent us this question. He says, I love your podcast. It's not a question, it's a statement, but I'll leave it in. I am a pre-med student who works in clinical research, and I can't help but notice all the medical students I work with second years, are excited and motivated and energetic. And the residents, which are in general PGY2s and 3s, are pretty bitter and angry and despondent. I was wondering if you could ask the medical students if they had any strategies for escaping this cycle. Thanks. Thanks for the question, Ross. Why do you guys think this is what... John, you might have the most to say about this at this point since you're 4.
No.
Or 3.
There you go.
What do you think? And guys, feel free to speculate. I mean, Matt, Gabe, and Jack are all M1s, so they're still in that idealistic, happy phase.
I think a big part of it is that there's a really big mismatch between what most people's impression of the practice of medicine is and what they end up doing. Even as a med student, you're kind of a tourist. Rotations here at the University of Iowa for med students are basically at the longest 6 weeks. And those are broken up into subsections. So you spend no more than 2 weeks basically doing anything any given time.
Lots of variety.
So you really don't get a chance to see what it's like to, you know, from day-to-day basis, come in every day and see these patients and do these, you know, whatever's procedures or whatever. And so you don't get to see the sort of soul-crushing day-in, day-out version of what it is you imagine that you'll be doing, you know? And so that's a big part of it. And the other part of it, and I think if you ask the residents, because as a med student, you really have no responsibility except a bunch of busy work that is really genuinely meaningless. I mean, they're learning opportunities, but you can learn on the job too. And yeah, we don't seem to respect that anymore.
The goal seems to be to learn despite what you're...
learning despite what you're required to do. Is the amazing amount of red tape. Once you're responsible and it's your job to do something, it becomes your job to do it.
Right.
And so when someone says you need to do X, Y, or Z, and if you don't know how to do that, or people who are supposed to do that with you or for you aren't doing it, you have to seal the deal.
Yeah.
And that's exhausting. And then combine that, with all of these other factors, like, you know, they're overworked and we're, you know.
So I did a little research, with air quotes, which meant I Googled some stuff. So residents' depressive symptoms go up about the rate of, I guess, what would you call that, the rate of their depressive symptoms?
Sure.
Prevalence, let's call it that. Go up
perfect.
About 15% after beginning their training. Doctors in general, and residents and probably medical students, fear the stigma of depression because it can hurt their reputation. There's a 2008 survey where 11% reported symptoms, but half of those who were surveyed reported knowing a doctor whose reputation had been hurt by depression. So this is a big fear, which leads to them not seeking treatment, right? And which means their satisfaction and their productivity just, you know, plummet. Weirdly, state medical boards ask specifically about mental health, even though the ADA and case law says that's discrimination. So many state boards are still asking these questions, like, you know, so that's another reason not to seek treatment. So yeah, it's kind of a big deal. 15% of members of the American College of Surgeons screened, who responded to a screening tool, have an alcohol abuse or dependence problem. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of, there's big problems here, you know? And so in general, they wait till, from what I've read, they wait till there's a crisis in order to act. And then...
Yeah, it becomes...
Not a lot of prevention here.
It's kind of a beautiful microcosm of our medical system in general. And I think it's a fault of our culture in medicine. Because what ends up happening is that no one wants to talk about it. And if you actually got them in a room where they're, you know, were able to talk about it in private among a group of physicians, it does very well. Mm-hmm. There's been some very interesting studies about physician burnout. I think it was done at Mayo, where they basically made the doctors take an hour and meet as a group and talk. And they did it for a year, and it definitely helped. Whereas they gave, it was sort of placebo controlled, so they, or randomized rather, they gave the other, they gave the other group, well, they gave the other group an hour to do whatever they wanted, you know, finish notes or whatever, but they gave them a protected hour to do that. Mm. And I guess it was weekly.
Yeah.
But it's a big thing in medicine, and it sort of typifies our culture at writ large opinion on, mental health, mental illness, and addiction, is that it, largely it's a character flaw, and that you're morally deficient. You know, and we could ask this of med students. I think this would be very interesting to get the private answers to this question. So let's say you drank a little too much on Sunday night and you weren't feeling great in clinic because you were hungover and you're not doing well, and your physician that you're working with says, hey, are you sick? You're kind of slow today. You know, would you tell them that you were drunk last night, or would you just tell them, well, you know, I'm sick? Well, I don't think anyone's going to be honest. Very few students would be honest.
I think it would be surprising in any professional situation for.
Yeah. And but here's the thing. Medicine. If we're going to agree, and I think if we then pulled the same sets of physicians, do you think that, you know, people who have alcohol problems are morally deficient in their character? They would say no.
Yeah.
Yet they're acting in a way that assumes that that action is, you know, something that calls into question your character, your morality, your goodness as a person, that you're bad and you've done the wrong thing. And medicine, unfortunately, tragically, has not done very much at all to recognize that, even within its own ranks.
So you guys are, you M1s, still, as I mentioned, sort of entering medicine, hopefully after a semester, haven't built up your jaded, cynical natures to an extent where it's at least, you know, interfering with your life. What are you guys doing so far? I mean, are you guys consciously, like, thinking, okay, I need to develop a strategy now?
I think a lot of your coping, how you deal with the stress on a day-to-day basis, kind of comes a lot from how you were before you got here. Like, is this something that, like, oh, this was the plan along the way? How hard did you have to work to get here? Is it, if you had to work a little more than a regular, like a normal, you know, if you had to work a little bit harder along the way than a lot of other people, it's going to feel a lot better, and so you can deal with the stresses a lot, in a lot easier way.
So you're saying that, are you saying that if you already have those coping skills, you're going to be okay?
Yeah. I don't know. I feel like...
I don't know, man.
I don't know. I feel like I dealt with a lot of, like, I struggled really poorly. I did very poorly in undergrad, and I did, like, I had to work so hard to get back to the point where I would, like, even be, like, a competitive candidate to get in.
Hey, man.
And then...
I'm with you, buddy. High five.
And then after
poor
that,
poor undergrad.
And then after that, though, it's just, like... You know, this is the payoff. This is what I've wanted, and, like, yeah, it's tough, but it's, like, not to the point to where, like, I feel bad about making this decision? I think it's just keeping like that sight, like this is what I wanted, this is what I want to do, and this is just part of what it takes to get to where I want.
All right, so what coping skills are you saying that
I'm pretty good about giving myself some time off, taking weekends off, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's important. That is important. I don't think you get, my guess is you're forced not to get enough of that during residency, from what I hear, right?
Yeah, depending on what you want to do.
But you have to. But the point is that you do have to do that. I mean, what about you?
Yeah, well, I think for medical students, especially as M1s, it's difficult for us to say that as a resident, all I have to do is just use these coping strategies, then everything's okay.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, right now we're busy. I feel busy. Yeah. But at the same time, am I at the level of a resident as far as busyness? I mean, talking about work limits, I mean, 80-hour weeks, only having 3 or 4 days off an entire month, like, would my coping strategies work after a 12-hour shift when all I want to do is sleep?
Yeah.
I mean, how do you do that?
Yeah. What do you think, Jack?
Right now, I do feel busy, like, a lot, but not busy enough that I'm going to study every day, all day. We just had our first test on a Monday, and before that, I had done nothing on a Friday or Saturday ever, like, school-related. That changed this weekend, and like going into this week, it's like, wow, that kind of sucks, like having to study all weekend, and then like, because you don't get any time off, you just go straight into it again. So I guess that if that was how
that's
it was
not the usual case, is
no.
it? For, for
no.
The,
no,
no, usually that was our only test we've ever had on Monday, and it
besides finals week,
yeah.
So I do want to respond to what Gabe said, because I feel like that's it's a really good point, and it's a really good thought process. I was very much in that boat. I just pretty much blew off a lot of college, and then I had to work really hard to get back to a place where I could, one, find what I wanted to do with my life, but two, you know, once I'd realized that medicine would be a good place for me, get myself in that position. And I would say just remember to be careful that that doesn't... It does help you, because I think it helps keep a larger picture drawn. But if the thing that you tell yourself to deal with it is, this is what I wanted to do, be very careful. Because you may want to do something, and it turns out that what you wanted to do is not actually what you have to do to do that thing, right?
What you thought,
So
you thought it would be.
Doing surgery doesn't entail what you thought it did something.
Yeah. And this I think that's a big... romanticized, like, view of what everything actually is.
Yeah, I think we don't do a good job of setting up that expectation with the structure of medical school.
Let's hear from some actual residents, shall we? I sent this question out on the old Facebook and got some CCOM grads to respond, and they're pretty good responding. Some of it confirms what we've discussed. That's the preview. Erica says, I think med school is the idealistic phase because you're not yet faced with the unending layers of bureaucracy put in place by Medicare, insurers, health systems. You still believe it's possible to practice medicine to help people. Then you enter residency and realize we are far too beholden to those who hold the purse strings. The dream of doing what is right for each patient is replaced with the reality of having to simply do what you can. And she says further, I think residents are exhausted and duped, but it does get better when you enter practice and you get better compensated for your efforts. So money does help a little bit. But there's still plenty of jumping through hoops that you have to do to care for your patients. So Miriam says, I'm only an intern, but I think sleep deprivation and lack of control over your own schedule are two things that make it harder to cope. And you know, I think we know lack of control is like a big predictor of depression, right? Mm-hmm. Like if you feel like you're out of control of your situation, that there's nothing you can do at that given, at that
moment. There's nothing that hurts these type A people more than that too.
Right, yeah, that's a good point. Catherine says, I found that as an intern, I was expected to become sort of, I'm wondering if these were self expectations, but was expected to become sort of a miracle godlike thing. And I fell quite short of that. Some have compared the process to breaking down and building up someone. However, in medicine, they forget the building up part. So that's...
And not to point fingers, I don't know these people at all, but if you haven't, if all of your life has been spent sort of in the school funnel, just going from one hoop to the next, it's very easy to miss that kind of perspective, that realization that... you know, you have to make yourself, that you have to meet the world head on, and in the space between where you are and the world that you're meeting, that's where you create yourself. And that's really difficult because of that pressure. You know, in medical school, you're sort of told what to do next. Mm. And that was one of the things that I wanted to address, is that, you know, what we do when we give everyone, when we say, here's what's expected of you, here's the rubric that you'll be graded on, here are the things that you need to do to get a perfect score, people aren't learning how to think independently there, how to build their model for how to do X, Y, or Z right. They just take the rubric and they just check off the boxes.
Yeah.
They're not actually thinking about the process and how to go forward. And once you get, you know, into a clinic and someone says, hey, you know, figure out how to get this insurance pre-authorization for this test, you know, like, that's exhausting to have to do that, you know, and not have built yourself around that.
Well, we do have some suggestions from these residents as well, which I think are helpful. First of all, Wanneke says choosing the right specialty is important. And you don't get, I mean, that's difficult, I think, because you don't, well, I mean, maybe in the current curriculum, there's a little more opportunity to explore.
More time
to explore. But in her day, I know that, you know, in her day, you had basically a year to do the core curriculum, and then you had, a year maybe to do that plus some selectives, and then there were relatively few electives. In the current curriculum, there's more time to do electives, which is a good thing, I guess.
I'm so hopeful for you guys in that. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Because for us, we have a year of required stuff, and then we get 8 weeks to do what we want, to get letters of recommendation, to apply for residencies. It's a travesty.
Erica takes solace, I guess, in realizing that she's wading through the bureaucratic bullshit on behalf of her patients. I mean, because no one else will do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll have to think about that one. But good on you, Erica. Miriam says, I try my hardest to stay positive, remind myself that I have the best job on earth, and to remember how amped I was. This is what I think John objected to a little while ago. But she does say, so she's OB-GYN. She says, I like to think of something one of my coworkers said about being an OB-GYN. It's our job to pull people out of people. That is super cool. So she has sort of, I love, she has sort of done what Wanneke suggested, which she's obviously chosen the right specialty.
Yeah, you know, I think this deserves a discussion here, because I want to know what you guys think. Like, what is it that you think would help you find the best specialty? And I don't think there's a right answer. I have my own personal opinion, which I will share.
We have no doubt.
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, what your thoughts are now, and then getting an idea of what it actually is, or like closer what it actually is when you're doing your rotations in certain specialties. And then I think a lot of people bring in thoughts like, oh, I think it'd be cool to do this because I shadowed an orthopedic surgeon for, you know, a week in undergrad and I thought it was cool. Well, you know, you can do anything. You can muscle anything for a week. You can muscle anything for a month.
Yeah.
It takes like a long time to get a really good picture of what you're getting yourself into, I think. And like I kind of came in with pretty much one thing on my mind that I want to do, and that's because I spent 5 years doing it prior to applying to med school. So I mean, I kind of have my mind made up, and like I've seen other specialties, but I don't know that I don't like them. I just know one thing I really do like.
So what specialty is that?
Emergency medicine.
What do you guys think?
Yeah, well, I think, as you mentioned, with the new curriculum, we have 2.5 years of clinical rotations instead of 2 years.
Excuse me, New Horizons curriculum?
Excuse me. Right. What did I call it?
The new curriculum.
Ooh.
I apologize. That was a big mistake.
That's all right.
Innovative curriculum.
I hate to call you out in public like this, but
well,
Matt.
Now that we got past that, hopefully.
All right.
The ice has been broken. The hatchet is buried officially.
I would say that, yeah, another semester, it definitely helps. Kind of like along what Gabe was saying, having these preconceived ideas, you get to see what you do and don't like, and obviously exposure is a big thing. I think, I mean, we can't speak to this yet, but having doctors in that specialty that actually love that specialty and can kind of project to you what it's like and, you know, kind of let you know what the actual lifestyle is. I think that's helpful too.
Yeah, I think having the higher exposure is definitely going to help. And I'm totally from a different world than Gabe because I've just gone straight through. But prior to coming here, I did a lot of shadowing with the different people, and my parents are both physicians. So I guess
I kind of had
an inside look of one, like the whole personal life as a physician, like what to expect. But I also trying to keep an open mind about not going into, this is what I want to go into right now. You know, I don't really have enough experience, I guess, to say, narrow it down so quickly.
Catherine has some good advice, I think. She says, I spent my time with patients. I was constantly being told that I was not efficient, which meant that I did not check off all the to-do boxes before the time came to generate a new list of check boxes. One of her mentors had a good suggestion, which is that she do the checky box stuff first, she says, and then go back later and do the things that seem to matter to her patients. So asking how they were doing, checking in on pets, finding out about shared good books and music, etc. So she wanted to develop a connection with her patients. The system doesn't really support that, but she made time to go back later after she was done with what the system wanted to do, things that interested her, which is finding out more about her patient. She says she escaped to the woods as often as she could to reconnect with nature. So she had an interest. She
stuck with it.
Stuck with that interest, or she found that interest to reconnect with something that's much older than her and is a testament to a presence bigger than her and the punishment wheel in which she had found herself. She read at least 5 minutes every night about something she was learning, and then she read fun stuff that she might not otherwise have read. She made friends outside of medicine, which she found difficult, but worth every minute. She kept in touch with her friends from medical school because, I mean, y'all are going to be doing it together, basically. Or you all can do it together if you keep in touch. Let's see. She performs physical exams, something which is apparently passé and apparently no longer necessary. She listens to both the words said and those not said. She asks for help. She calls on residency colleagues to ask questions that are outside of her scope of practice. But I think that ask for help thing could mean more, right? I mean, if you are feeling, you know, like things aren't going well, you need to ask for help, you know, mentors, other people, whoever.
Does she also brush her teeth? She lists that as well.
She did
just,
not.
Just like listing off all of the things you do on a day-to-day basis.
She did not.
My life is perfect, and here's how.
Well, I don't think it's perfect. She says, I think I'm angry at times, perhaps more than others could understand, but I am not so much bitter as I am jaded. I try to keep it under wraps when necessary. I think I still like people. I like, but she also says, and this is totally,
talking herself
this is totally Catherine. God love you, Catherine. I like proving people wrong and seeing kids smile. So that's, you know, that's good stuff.
So I wanted to go back to the how to pick a medical specialty because I thought that was, you know, I think a good resistance to burnout is to find something that suits you really well. And I think from seeing a lot of things in this hospital, I think the one thing I found most interesting is personalities. Personality is probably your least mutable characteristic. You can get good at almost anything. But if you don't fit in with the personality of your colleagues, you know, if you don't fit in with the personality of, you know, an orthopedic surgeon, you know, you're going to have to work with other orthopedic surgeons. It's going to be challenging. It's from residency through your career. And I think that if you lead with that, that becomes a very interesting thing because it also really follows with the data. People like things and find them satisfying if they're good at them. You get good at things that you do a lot, and you're going to do something a lot if you can stick with it because you have enough sort of common ground that you're able to sustain that existence. And you're going to sustain that existence well if you are well suited to the sort of personality characteristics of that field. And if you look at things like, there's a reason why surgeons tend to be, you know, one way and internists tend to be another way with respect to personality, because the nature of the work relies more upon that. You know, things like radiology relies upon your ability to make visually based judgments. And that's, to a certain extent, an element of personality. Some people don't really have that in them. And so some things, you know, with pediatrics, you're seeing tons of kids. You got to talk with kids. You got to talk with parents. It's almost like veterinary medicine in that sense. You know, like you're talking to the owner of this patient.
As a parent, I can confirm that children are animals.
As a parent, I agree. And so that's a very different skill set, right? From radiology, yeah. Right? And so the way that you interact, that's very important to consider, I think. That's probably the most fundamental thing. Because again, you know, you can teach, most anyone in medical school can learn how to tie all these crazy knots and tie them backwards and tie them blind and folded and, you know, there's all sorts of things in surgery, yeah, where you might be suturing something you can't actually see. Right. So you've got to tie this knot behind something.
I love the comment.
They don't blindfold you, yeah, in surgery,
I love
hopefully.
I love the comment that I often read in the medical student performance evaluations. He or she won the knot tying contest.
Is it sarcastic or is it true?
I think it's true because it appears
often.
Somewhat often.
I think it's a big deal.
I guess so, among surgeons. Was there anything else?
I was going to say, I totally agree with what John said. I was at my early clinical experience earlier this week, and that's what the doctor's advice to me there was, that you really have to find your camp of thinking within each specialty, and they all think differently. Orthopedics, if you can't fix it with a hammer, get a bigger hammer. He said ophthalmology, which is what he was doing, is more like I'm fixing a fine Swiss watch, very delicate, very... And obviously he's biased towards himself, but
it's funny, and I already know who you're talking about too, just based on that statement.
Yeah, and I think that's definitely true, that everyone goes about things differently. Yeah. And
are you saying that's like built into the process, like subconsciously, or that's something you need to really think about?
I think that's a hidden curriculum thing. But you really, if you go into it thinking about it like that, that will help you tremendously. Because, for example, you say, hey, I would be really well suited to this handful of things, and half of them are very competitive, and I think I might like the work in this one more than the other one. Boom, there's what you do your summer research in, mm-hmm, you know? like those are good ways of a sort of heuristic screening tool, right? Like you've come up with a way of trying to figure out how to make your life easier in that search. And don't get me wrong, there's always black swans in fields. I've met people where I'm like, you're not like the others. I don't say it out loud, but I think it. And they're oftentimes extraordinarily good at what they do.
Yeah.
You know, and that these are the people who had this mission. You know, they were just like, I absolutely have to do blank, whatever it is. I was just captivated, and then I went into it. You know, and these people end up being extremely good at it. But that's kind of a you know it when you see it thing. And if you have to think about whether you have that or not, you don't. So don't worry about it.
I think finding a way, you know, the control, having control over your life thing. So obviously really difficult, but I'm wondering if, and we really have to wrap this up because I've got one more thing we need to do, but finding a way to assume control in some way, doesn't have to be the whole way, but finding a way to take control of what's happening to you is probably a useful thing if you can manage it. And that could be something very small. It could be just deciding, for instance, and I've said this before on the show, deciding what success is for you as opposed to allowing other people to define success.
Right, Dave, for you. Just tell us all to lower our standards, why don't you?
Well, I don't say necessarily lowering your standards, although that's how I live my life.
If it's a good point, you know, if someone says, I'm going to cram you into a box, you have no choice.
Yeah.
Then at least pick a box that
pick
you fit
box,
in.
Yeah.
Right? Right? Like.
Well, I think it's in Zombieland, don't they say, it's the little things that count? Like, enjoy the small victories.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
If you can find that small victory.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, Ross, thank you so much for your question. Love to answer questions, so, you know, definitely send them in, people. And now we're going to turn to the world of sports, because unfortunately, the Hawkeyes lost an alumni, Tyler
Sash.
Sorry, as regular listeners will know that I am not as... Well, he died in September.
Yeah.
But it came out this week that he, in fact, did suffer from chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And here, as our sports commentator, is Jason T. Lewis.
So, yeah, as Dave said, Tyler Sash was, I guess, the latest person to be diagnosed with CTE, which is unfortunately something that can only be diagnosed post-mortem.
Correct.
And it's been a story that has come up over the past several years. Former professional football players and some folks who didn't even make it all the way to the professional ranks are coming, you know, there's lots of stuff that's going on with them, and then they've identified this chronic brain injury disease. In fact, I was doing research for this, I saw that Bennett Amalu, who's the doctor who first identified CTE, has gone on record as saying he would bet his medical license that O.J. Simpson suffers from CTE. Of course, there's no way to know, but based on O.J.'s behavior and some anecdotal stories about his relative confusion here and there, Amalu seems pretty confident. And I guess one thing that I'm interested in, as we talk about this, I mean, it's a tragedy for sure. But it's a tragedy that's sort of tied up in lifestyle choices to a certain extent, and social norms, how we think, how we, you know, where football slots into the zeitgeist of American life. You know, football, sports in general, but football in particular, is sort of as an entertainment commodity, recession proof.
Yeah.
You know, everybody will watch football. Everybody, you know, the numbers will stay the same no matter what's going on. That's why Super Bowl commercials, you know, a 30-second spot can be millions of dollars for an advertising, you know, spot there. So we got the Super Bowl coming up. So levels of attention are being paid to football. And yet, on, you know, the seedy underbelly of this is this chronic disorder that comes from that comes from the playing of football. So I guess my question is, what do you guys think about CTE as medical students, future physicians, but also the social aspects of it, how it fits into our culture, and where it's going to go from here?
I'm really torn on the idea. Like, I want my kids to, like, be able to play football. I remember back in high school, like, some of my best memories from high school were on Friday nights going out playing football. And Jack can talk about this too. He played football in college. And it's just like, it was so much fun. And I want my kid to experience that. But then again, I see things like this, and it's just like, not worth it in any way.
Yeah, I think the thing that's really shocking about Tyler Sash and this diagnosis is he was 27 years old when he died. Mm-hmm. And he had what, you know, they rank CTE on levels of 0 to 4, and he ranked a level 2. And yet they pointed out that by the time he had passed away, he had played 16 years worth of football.
Yeah.
So I agree with you. I'm a lover of sports, and I enjoy watching football. And there are things about the game of football, as I've sort of thought about the history of it and how the game has changed and how the players have changed and how all of that, that makes me wonder about its future, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree with Gabe. I'm also torn, like, will I let my children play? Because I played, you know, from the moment they let me, and I played in college for a few years at the D3 level. But I think one of the big deals, it gets so much more intense, especially when you're playing like levels like Sash, and he was D1 and professional, but even in D3, I mean, I know people that had undiagnosed concussions that just don't say it because
you want to play.
Yeah, the mentality right, of football right. is to keep playing. And I was a little shocked that there's so many more injuries because you're playing at such a higher level. Like, I would weekly, more than weekly basis, I would see people get knocked unconscious constantly. Like, in a tackle, I've seen two people knock each other at the same time, like, mm-hmm. multiple times. And I was kind of shocked when I got to college. I was like, wow, like, this is really, they're kicking it up a notch. It's a big deal. And people, a lot of people aren't aware of the repercussive effects that could have to happen to them later. And I,
right.
So I think that's kind of an issue, this player education.
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess I would also say, as future medical professionals, I mean, it'd be tough to recommend to, say, a high school student that I think it's a good idea to play football, given what we know now about CTE. But I guess I will say, for my part, I did not play football in high school nor in college. I peaked as an eighth grade tight end on the B team. So maybe it was my lack of skill as opposed to concerns about injury that contributed to that. So
yeah. I mean, I also played when I was young, but I had to make the choice between marching band and football, and chose marching band. So I look back on that now with a little bit of what might have been. Because
I feel the same way.
Yeah. But the thing that's really, really fascinating to me, and I did a little bit of looking up, and Dave and I were talking about this as we were moving forward. I wanted to know, how has the athlete changed in the history of the NFL and football in general from the inception of major professional football up to now? And we found statistics that showed that, let me see, I think I have it here. The average weight in 1950 of an offensive tackle was 240 pounds. The average weight of an offensive tackle today is somewhere around 200 or 320 pounds. A lot of the folks who were initially diagnosed with CTE, like Mike Webster, who was a center for the Pittsburgh Steelers in the 80s, these offensive linemen who, it's that repetitive action of slamming yourself into another 300 and something pound dude, 16 weeks of the year plus practice over and over and over again. I mean, there's that. But then if you look at, there are football players in the skilled positions like wide receiver, running back, people like that, who can run upwards of 24, 25 miles an hour. Think about a collision with someone at that speed.
Especially when opposite directions too. Double that.
Yeah, it's just the inertial impact of and what you can do to offset it. What would you have to do to a football helmet to protect the brain from chronic brain injury? And I know that they've tried different technologies and they're always trying to develop something, but until we get into science fiction territory of like inertial dampers or something. Where do you go from there?
Take away the helmet,
yeah, rugby style.
Give them a soft helmet and just say, any hitting that you're gonna do, you're not as protected as you used to be. You're gonna have to tone it down. But I think, I don't know that there will be a solution. And so the question, what I think is really ultimately gonna be borne out, and the thing that really terrifies me about this, is the families of these guys. They say, that's not my son, that's not my husband, that's not my dad there anymore. And on the other hand, you've got the NFL making billions of dollars off these guys,
right?
Making the taxpayers pay for stadiums, and all the while we're just grinding through these young, talented, capable people. And it is an absolute travesty what is happening. And I don't even know how to process it. I literally cannot watch the sport anymore.
Yeah, well, it's hard to really, when you really start to think about it, there's a lot that doesn't compute. I mean, the NFL is a tax-free nonprofit organization. Yeah. It's a nonprofit, which is it? We all know it's a for-profit business, but they have somehow been able to maintain that tax-free nonprofit status, which doesn't make any sense. But and also just this whole idea of, and like I say, I'm a football fan. I think that part of why people are huge fans of football is the speed and intensity of the game. And you're going to go up against a very powerful organization in the NFL with lots of hands in its pockets. And when saying we need to take away the helmet or change the gear in some way that makes it so that the game has to slow down and has to be less impactful, and I think by and large the response from the public would be, well, it's their choice.
Yeah. Well, and we know they don't care. I mean, we know the NFL doesn't care, and here's how we know. Because this whole game has been played before by an industry whose product was known to grind through people.
Cigarettes?
The cigarette industry.
Yeah.
And the cigarette industry had an absolutely brilliant tactic. And what they said was, cigarettes might cause cancer or lung disease, but we're going to wait for the science to be settled. You know, we're going to let, before we do anything, before we take any action, you know, let's wait till the science is settled. And the NFL has done just that, exactly that. They've put themselves in the position to do absolutely nothing for as long as absolutely possible, so they can go as long as possible doing nothing about it. And it's the same thing that, you know, BP and those companies are taking with global warming, and it works really well. Let's wait for the science to be settled. Nobody knows what that means. Everyone's, we know CTE is happening. We know it's caused by football. Yeah. You know, it's not the only thing that causes it, but
yeah. Well, I mean, it's one of those gray. It's unfortunately a gray area where people really enjoy it, and there's a ton of money being made on it. So, you know, at what point do you? Well, Teddy Roosevelt actually, back in the early 20th century, almost banned football because early football was a much different game, but it was becoming increasingly brutal, and I think people were dying on the field. And so he got to the point where he said, you know, I'm thinking about totally banning this game. And there were changes made, and it went forward. But when the president of the United States comes in and says, you know, these kids are dying playing this game, it doesn't seem like a good idea. Maybe, I mean, is that what it's going to take to see some high speed, high impact collision in the defensive backfield of a, you know, on a Sunday afternoon, and someone dies on the field? Is that when?
To be honest, I don't think that would stop it. I think the game would still continue. I guess the part I'm kind of interested about is from the player's side, because you have people from, in many cases, a lower socioeconomic status. So for these people, if they didn't have football, what sorts of opportunities would they have to make money and to make millions of dollars?
Well,
I mean, not millions always.
They all went to college and got a free college education. So clearly they, I mean, that's another hypocrisy for another day. But
right.
But yeah, I mean, if somebody came up to you tomorrow and said, hey, do this for 5 years and I'll pay you $15 million each year. And by the end, you might have some lifelong side effects, but you'll have, what, $50 million? Or, geez, even more than that if it's 50, you know. So I think anybody, regardless of socioeconomic status, would say, like, well, I'll take my chances.
Yeah,
okay. Right. Yeah. I think, yeah, basically nowadays, especially, well, I guess previously in the NFL, yeah, they just didn't tell anybody. And so a lot of players were mad, and their families have tried to sue the NFL over it, about they've had their CTE, if they didn't even know it was CTE back then. But the NFL is basically modern-day gladiator fights.
Right.
It's, people love that kind of thing, and that's why we watch it. And so I think even if someone dies, I don't think it would decrease in publicity at all. I think it would add, people would, just like gladiators, they made a ton of money, entertained millions of thousands of people. Football's going to be the same thing.
Yeah. And what does it say really about the human animal writ large? It's not a new thing. You can't blame it on American culture entirely. It's something that has gone on in different ways in different cultures for centuries. So, but at the same time, as medical professionals and potentially as parents down the line, I mean, you know, I have a son. I got him. I encouraged him to play football. I played football myself, and I recognize like that there's a place for it. There are good, and this isn't to demonize football. I mean, there are aspects of this where we can demonize. We can say the NFL was actively trying to at least keep our eyes off of these kinds of things. We could say that, you know, the monetary aspects of it encourage people to make poor health choices. But from a medical standpoint, you know, what do you guys think you'll encounter as things go on? I mean, you're thinking about going into emergency medicine.
Correct.
What's your take on it?
I don't know. I see a lot of parents asking, like, I'm sure in the future parents will be asking questions like, oh, if they don't play football, you know, what's the risk of, or if they do play football, what's the risk of developing this? And it's like, you don't know. And you know, like I said it before, like I would hate for a child to miss out on like the great experience that playing high school football can be. But beyond that, when people are getting bigger, getting stronger, getting faster, hitting harder, like that's when you have these constant repetitive issues. And 4 years of college, you're playing football for a couple hours a day, every single day, mm-hmm. 365 days a year. Like, I mean, if you, maybe not all through the summer, but you're still taking hits constantly.
Yeah.
And like that, like in high school, you train for a couple months, you work out in the off season, you're not hitting each other. But when you're doing it for a job, and in college, it's your job, like that's what you're getting paid to do, you're taking a lot more hits. And right. that's where I think it's getting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think things have changed, and they are continuing to change. People are getting more and more worried about it. When my parents moved to Iowa as physicians, at the time the high school would offer like a cheap physical, sport physical, like in the high school gym, so everyone could get their physicals and play, you know, whatever sport. The doctors at the time were just like, you know, yeah, you're healthy, whatever, your heart sounds okay, you're good enough. My parents get there and like there's people with like heart murmurs and stuff, all kinds of like issues that the other doctors were just signing off on. Like, you guys can't play football, like, you yeah. know, if you get hit in the chest in the right way, you like could die. And so like they were, I think it's now changing. People, my mom always says she would guess let me play, and I'm like, I'm fine for now. We'll see 40 years down the line if that changes.
10 years from now, you're like in your room, like, you know. But no, I think that's a good point. I think our understanding of, you know, from a medical standpoint, our ability to diagnose things, our understanding of the impacts of certain dangers are much more acute than they were. And like I said, also the physical prowess of the athletes is just so much different. I mean, even we looked at statistics for baseball and basketball and football, and the average American has gained 50 pounds in the past 50 years. And now, not all of that is ho-hos. You know, there's some sort of evolutionary thing going on, or you know, some sort of nature and nurture thing that's happening. I mean, this is where the pseudoscience comes in. It's like they also started putting steroids in the feed of animals in the 50s. And so, I mean, it seems to be, you know, on its face a causality. You know, food source changes, the people who eat the food change.
Right. I guess as a future medical professional, or even presently as a medical professional, I think, you know, I'm so torn, you know, because I feel like I have a moral obligation or an ethical duty to tell, you know, to give the best advice. And what you're doing is you're taking your child and you're playing a game of a very protracted game of Russian roulette with your child. And I don't think in any way, shape, or form that that's an appropriate thing to do.
Yeah.
And it's weird, you know, because it's, I mean, it's one thing to be like, well, they undergo more risk in, you know, driving a car, which is true. But no one needs to play football.
Well,
you know, but then again, there are people whose, you know, parents believe in it so strongly that it's like, you know, my child isn't a valuable child if they don't play football. And I've seen this.
Yeah.
I mean, this is literally like the child is here for headache, concussion. They've been seen multiple accounts, you know, and the parent is like, well, you know, he can go back to play now, right?
Well, yeah. When does,
they won't take any amount of no for an answer.
At
what point is that child abuse?
Right. That's what I was going to say. At what point? And this might be something that will affect people as medical professionals down the line. I mean, as mandatory reporters, what do you say if you see an environment that is encouraging repetitive injury? That might seem far-fetched, but it's also one of those things that I think bears consideration as a mandatory reporter of any kind of child abuse. And there's that level of obstinance when it comes to getting back on the field and playing the game. A lot of times those things are user-induced. You know, the person who's playing wants to continue to play. And at that point, what do you do? But we've known that cigarettes were bad for people for a long, long time, and yet I have a couple of advertisements from magazines from back in the 50s, you know, of doctors who recommend Camel cigarettes because they help with weight loss. You know, like, you know, so it's one of those situations where it's never going to be a perfect system where everything, you know, sort of every piece of advice that you give as a physician is going to work for everyone else, but there has to be some sort of balance. And
you might be surprised how the culture changes, because the culture changed. Boy, we did a whole 180 on that one, didn't we?
Yeah. Well, you know, watching your parents die of lung cancer also has an effect.
Right. And then how many of these young kids need to kill themselves, die of an overdose, kill their family members, you know,
get
chased in a Bronco, you know, in a white Bronco down the strip in L.A.
Well, you know,
how many of these?
Sorry, OJ.
The OJ thing has become sort of a cultural punchline, but at the center of it, if in fact OJ Simpson is a victim of CTE,
he's not morally deficient of character, you know.
No, I mean, if he is. And the symptoms of CTE include, you know, mood swings and penchants for violence, violent outbursts. I mean, yes, the glove didn't fit, but, you know, at what point do we say this becomes a public danger, a danger to the public? I mean, if
that's kind of the next layer. That's interesting.
Yeah, and I think that eyes are being opened now. They have all kinds of concussion rules now in high school and in the NCAA. I know in the NCAA, if you are suspected of a concussion, you can't play until you're cleared by a physician, which was not the rules. And in high school, they're making rules like that now, too, and I think that's great. Because I know when I played in high school, I had a concussion, and I was supposed to not play, but I tried to play. I was dressed out of practice, and then I didn't know. So my dad, and he's a physician, had talked to the coach and said, hey, Jack has a concussion. He shouldn't play. So I actually was all padded up on the field ready to go. And my coach says, what are you doing? I'm like, no, nothing. And he's like, you got a concussion. You have to sit out. I'm like, so I think I think that's part of the football mentality. It's just that people, it's just what you're supposed to do, what people think.
Like,
and
you know, rub some dirt on it. You got to be tough.
And
you know, I mean, there's all these stories like Ronnie Lott cutting his finger off so he could play, you know, like crazy things like that.
Are you injured or hurt?
Yeah. but then there's also stuff that, even the NFL now, they have independent doctors on the sidelines. They have concussion protocols and everything like that. But, you know, when it's a multi-billion dollar business, there's certainly some pressure to continue.
Well, the thing is, like, at the end of the day, it's an inherently violent sport. You brought up baseball before, and talking about catcher collisions. I mean, that was a big deal for a while. People would get concussions from that. Or Buster Posey, I think, tore an ACL or something.
Broken leg.
Or something like that, yeah. And, I mean, they legislated that out of the game. They took away catcher collisions to protect people from concussions and other injuries.
Right.
I mean, you can do that to baseball and not change the nature of the game. I mean, kind of like we were talking about with soft helmets or whatever. I mean, how do you change the nature of football?
Right. I mean, the whole evolution of football has been bigger, stronger, faster, hit harder, you know, and taking that out of it, then is in many ways a regression of the sport.
Well, as I have learned throughout my life, people who love football can talk forever about football. But we got to close it out for today. So on that note. Listeners, thanks so much for listening today. I should say, as I said before, nothing makes us happier than hearing from you. Without you, we might as well be shouting into a hole. So keep those questions and comments coming. Lots of ways to do that. Like talking to us at theshortcoat.com, Twitter, Facebook, lots of ways to get in touch with us. If you leave a voicemail... Here, I'm going to up the ante. I'm going to go crazy. If you leave a voicemail, I can play on the air by calling 347-SHORT-CT. That's 347-746-7828. I will send you a pair of socks I was given by a vendor and which I can't keep because it would be a violation of some law.
They're MailChimp socks, too.
No, we're not buzz marketing companies, Jason Lewis.
They have monkeys on them.
They do have monkeys on them. The show is made possible by intern Corey, who will one day leave us. And so I'm searching for a new intern. very soon. Starting this fall. Get in touch. He didn't know I was going to make this announcement. So I'm not kicking you out the door yet, Corey. It's okay. It's okay, dude.
You got like 15 minutes to get the heck out.
Get in touch if you'd like to know more about filling his shoes. Oh, I didn't tell you you can have to fill your shoes. And by a generous donation by Carver College of Medicine Student Government and the Writing and Humanities Program. Did I run out of music? Oh, goodbye.
Bye.